Thank you, Sue, and greetings to all. So as a roadmap for the 90-minute session that we have allocated, the idea is to have the FASB staff first provide a 15-minute update, and then the IASB staff, and then open it up to discussion with the board members. So we have two sets of slides for today's topic. Reference 18A is the material for the FASB update. Again, my name is Joy, and allow me to walk you through the first 15 minutes. So as an overview, at the last joint meeting, which took place July of 2019, the FASB had then just issued our invitation to comment. And at the joint meeting, we shared some of the questions from that document. Today, I'll share some of the high-level feedback from our recent efforts. And subsequently, the board and staff are seeking comments and will answer questions on stakeholder feedback and the general direction of our project. You know, we initially planned on a decision-making meeting yesterday, but that meeting was canceled and postponed given the additional work that the team has to perform. So let me share with you what transpired. On the slide on the invitation to comment, we hit two mileposts last year. We received over 100 comment letters in response to our ITC and hosted two public roundtables to counterbalance more user views with the preparer views in conjunction with other stakeholder views. Since the project was added to our agenda, the staff has had over 200 interactions with stakeholders. And so in terms of the comments that we received at a high level, that's on the next slide. Overall, there were many contingent views. So as an example, we often heard that any further impairment testing changes should be considered only after understanding the details of a goodwill amortization model. And of course, there were also consequential considerations such as that were brought up in the comment letters, such as transition issues. So on the four quadrant chart that you might see there, this highlights the divergent reasonings for either supporting an impairment only model or an amortization with impairment model. And so from a conceptual standpoint, similar to the IASB staff members, the FASB staff members were also hoping to find and encounter something conceptually new. However, whether goodwill is a wasting or a non-wasting asset continues to be debated among stakeholders and appears to be an eternal controversy. From a practical standpoint, we heard much about the cost side of the equation, and those costs seem to be clear and apparent with the issuance of critical audit matters as defined by the PCAOB. To some degree, these costs that we are hearing about were more quantifiable when compared with user views, and that is why understanding the user views has been an area of focus for our team. So on the slide on general user views, I just wanted to give some color. We reached out to over 150 analysts who follow companies that have had recent impairments in the past 2 to 3 years. And we interviewed about 20 of them, some saying that goodwill impairments are a critical signal, while others have noted that it's merely confirmatory. So it's not necessarily easy to categorize where most users sit at this point, and it depends on where and how users get their information. However, this is a summary of how we heard from analysts during the outreach efforts, and we bucketed them into three categories. So starting from the bottom, Camp 3 is where we heard many analysts are quite indifferent to the accounting change because whether goodwill is amortized or impaired, both are non-GAAP measures, and there were no cash impact at that specific point in time. Camp 2, there are also many that we spoke to during outreach that find goodwill impairments to have informational value, but were actually sympathetic to the cost-benefit balance that the board is trying to debate at the moment. And so they had said that there are other ways that analysts are able to find information leading up to goodwill impairments. And perhaps what's being said is that any form of goodwill that exists through business combination can be observed through the margins and the cash flows. In Camp 1 yet, there are others who express that goodwill impairments are critical trigger signals, and we observe that from perhaps maybe less sophisticated investors and from certain CFA Institute members. But what seemed consistent among all the users, though, is the belief that goodwill impairments information becomes significantly less useful over time. So we always keep that in the back of our heads as we do our analysis. On the next slide, since we're here with international stakeholders, perhaps I thought to share some comments related to comparability. In the ITC, we asked stakeholders to identify which aspects of comparability were most important to them and why that is. So from the bottom, you know, I just thought to highlight that related to US GAAP and IFRS, more than half of the respondents did not answer this question. And when stakeholders did respond, some supported comparability in an area where both standards are currently largely converged. Okay, so more recently in the July board meeting, that's on the next slide, the board asked the staff to come back with the amortization details first before any other consideration. So the Venn diagram that we have here really for the board meet next board decision-making meeting is focusing on that circle labeled A, whether or not to amortize goodwill, and then moving on to E for any potential changes to the impairment model and potentially revisiting B where there could be any revisiting prior decisions as both of those models overlap. So on the next slide is last week during the November 11th educational meeting that the board discussed the qualitative aspects of whether a default amortization period should be prioritized over any management judgment. And this slide just summarizes part of that discussion for those of us who followed it. Now, theoretically speaking, more information value could result if there were more cost and effort placed by preparers and management with these determinations. However, we do know that the correlation between cost and information value may not necessarily be proportionate. So as an example, more specifically, with amortization period, there's an alternative, which you'll see in column two there, where there is a default provided with the option to deviate similar to the private company alternatives that US GAAP has today. Now, comparing that with the third column, where the alternative requires management to provide judgment first before allowing a default. So, this would require management to first attempt to determine an amortization period, and if they cannot do so reliably, then use the default period. So just as an observation, there would be significant increased costs and potentially a disproportionate increase in information value to users between these alternatives. So that was debated in the educational meeting last week on November 11th, but there were also two key messages that I got out of it from that educational meeting last week, just to get everybody familiarized. The first is the decision on an amortization model might be iterative in a sense where the tentative decisions that will be made first under an assumption that the current impairment model remains unchanged and unchanged with the current annual impairment testing requirement and the testing for the under a current reporting unit structure. And then perhaps having the need to revisit those decisions on goodwill amortization after considering any impairment testing changes to be deliberated at a later date, if that makes sense. And the other key message that I got from the educational meeting last week from the board is that the board is looking for prior SEC comment letters related to an extremely short or an extremely long amortization period to better understand the practice issues that existed back in the days during that time. So as a next steps, the board meeting was canceled yesterday, and we're hoping to reschedule that in mid-December for a decision-making meeting. I also noted there about the CFA Institute survey that we were expecting, and I believe the survey is already out for comment or for feedback, but it's very simplistic type. From my understanding and seeing the survey questions, is a very simplistic 5-question Q&A that I'm not sure how much we would get information out of that survey. And lastly here, we are looking forward to the comments that the ISB and the staff will be getting related to the discussion paper that will be closing at the end of this year.
Thank you, Joy. So now we're going to hand to Craig.
Yeah, thank you, Sue. And thank you, Joy. And hello to the members of both boards. So I'd like to provide a brief introduction to the ISB's discussion paper, Business Combinations, Disclosures, Goodwill and Impairment. So we are a little bit behind the process in the US, and this discussion paper was published in March this year. We're still in the comment period, so the ISB has asked for comments by the end of this year. The discussion paper covers three main areas, and it responds to feedback that the ISB received in the post-implementation review of IFRS 3 business combinations. So the first area in the discussion paper is about disclosures, and in particular, the ISB is considering some additional disclosures on the subsequent performance of acquisitions, as well as some minor improvements to the existing disclosure requirements. Secondly, the discussion paper includes the ISB's preliminary views on the accounting for goodwill. So the ISB considered whether it could improve the effectiveness of the impairment test to reduce what's called the too little too late problem, whether to reintroduce amortization, as well as some simplifications to the test that will hopefully reduce the cost of performing the impairment test. And lastly, there's a few other areas, and probably the most notable item in here is the ISB's thoughts on whether to change the recognition criteria for identifiable intangible assets acquired in a business combination. So if I go through each of these areas in a bit more detail, I'll give you a flavour of the feedback that we've heard on the discussion paper so far. So if we start with disclosures then, the ISB's preliminary views would require companies to disclose in the year of acquisition the strategic rationale and the detailed objectives for the acquisition, as well as the metrics and targets that management are going to use to monitor whether that acquisition has been a success. And then in subsequent years, companies would disclose the progress in meeting those objectives using the metrics that they set out in the year of acquisition. And these disclosures follow a management approach. So it would require companies to disclose the information that the chief operating decision maker is using to monitor the success of the acquisition. In terms of feedback on this preliminary view, investors have really reaffirmed the feedback that they provided to the board in the PIR of IFRS 3. So investors often say that companies provide information at the time of acquisition, for example, in press releases or in presentations during investor days about the objectives of the acquisition. And that information can sometimes include hints as to what KPIs might be monitored by management. So for example, sometimes they give information about the target levels of synergies. But investors say that they rarely get information about the subsequent performance of the acquisitions, although there might be some variation on that by industry. And preparers typically say that while they understand the needs of investors, they do have some practical concerns about providing this information. So one of the most common bits of feedback that we hear is that some say that this information should be in management commentary rather than in financial statements. And the problem with that being that the ISB has no tool to require the provision of information in management commentary. The ISB's practice statement here is voluntary. So the other main concern is commercial sensitivity. And we challenge preparers a little bit on this in terms of what exactly it is they think is commercially sensitive. The examples we often get back are things around giving information about to competitors about how management actually price deals. And that could arise from disclosing information about specific targets, which might allow those competitors to work out the multiples that management have used in valuing those potential targets. Other examples are sensitivity, redundancies in cost synergies. But as I mentioned previously, as investors tell us that some of that information is actually available at the time of acquisition. And so they push back and say that that information and presumably any update on whether those objectives have actually been met, presumably isn't commercially sensitive given it was disclosed in some of those other materials. During the development of the discussion paper, the ISB heard concerns that integration might prevent a company from disclosing the information. But when we ask preparers about this, in practice, it usually turns out that management do have some kind of information that they use in monitoring the performance of acquisitions. And that's often part of the company's internal control mechanism. Preparers do sometimes raise concerns about the auditability of the information. But when we speak to auditors, they tend to say that they think the information will be auditable, but it will come at a cost. And we heard mixed views about the use of the CODM in identifying the disclosures. I'd say most recognize this as at least a practical attempt to get the right volume of disclosures, but some do say that in their organization, the CODM reviews very little information about the subsequent performance of acquisitions, while others actually say that the CODM reviews information about the performance of all of the company's acquisitions. And so there's a bit of a mix there. The other minor improvements to existing disclosures includes requiring the disclosure of expected synergies, defining pension liabilities and debt assumed, as well as some of the changes to actual and pro forma information that need to be disclosed about an acquiree. And probably the most controversial in the outreach so far has been the ISB's views about synergies, which attract some of the same comments about subsequent performance disclosures. that I've already gone through. So if we move on to goodwill itself then, the ISB did spend a considerable amount of time trying to improve the effectiveness of the test, but concluded that it wasn't feasible to do so at a reasonable cost. Some regulators and some auditors have disagreed with the ISB's suggestion that management over-optimism in the impairment test is only an implementation issue, and that is best dealt with by regulators and auditors rather than through standard setting. So some of them have suggested ideas for potential additional disclosures, or that the ISB should provide more guidance on how to allocate goodwill to CGUs that they say might help in combating management over-optimism and therefore improving the effectiveness of the impairment test. So the ISB also discussed where to reintroduce amortization of goodwill. The framing of the question was slightly different to the project on the FASB's agenda. And because the question arose in the context of the PIR by IFRS 3, the ISB is asking whether there's compelling evidence that a change is needed and that changing back to an amortization model would significantly improve financial reporting. The ISB's preliminary view was to retain the impairment-only approach, but that was by a narrow majority. So the ISB, as Joy mentions, specifically asked stakeholders to provide new evidence or new arguments on this topic. And I would say in our outreach to date, we've not really heard anything new, although some do think that the findings of the PIR is new evidence. Stakeholders' views do continue to be mixed on this topic. I'd say investors, and especially equity investors, are more likely to say that the impairment-only approach provides better information than an amortization approach, but other stakeholders are much more mixed. Those who have commented on conversions with US GAAP usually say that while in general it's important consideration, it shouldn't be the ISB's main goal when making decisions in this area. Lastly, on goodwill, there's some simplifications to the test that were discussed by the ISB, and this includes removing the requirement to perform the quantitative test every year and instead move to an indicator-based approach. I'd say we've had some mixed views on this idea. Some say it will reduce costs without having a significant impact on the robustness of the test, but there are some that are concerned that it will make it more difficult for auditors and regulators to challenge management, and the companies might find it easier to avoid an impairment because of that. So we have asked those stakeholders to explain why they think this would be the case. Others also say that the ISB should focus on making an existing practical expedient in the impairment standards IAS 36 around the ability to kind of roll forward impairment tests easier to apply in practice rather than focusing on this indicator-based approach. So the ISB is also considering some simplifications to how value and use is calculated. So as a reminder, value and use is one of the two methods that companies can use to calculate recoverable amount in IFRS for use in the impairment test. So value and use is based on how management intend to use a CGU rather than how the market prices the CGU. And the ISB is considering allowing companies to use post-tax discount rates and cash flows, and also removing some of the restrictions on what cash flows an entity is allowed to include in calculating value in use. And the latter should hopefully make cash flows more similar to those used internally in management budgeting. Stakeholders have been fairly supportive of these ideas, although there is some that are concerned that removing restrictions on what cash flows an entity includes might increase management over-optimism in the impairment test. So lastly, on the other topics, this includes an area or an idea to require companies to present a line item for equity excluding goodwill on the balance sheet. And this idea hasn't had much support from stakeholders. They generally say that investors can already calculate this amount, but also that presenting that amount on the balance sheet might call into question whether goodwill is really an asset or not. The other area was, as I mentioned earlier, the recognition of identifiable and tangible assets acquired in an acquisition separately from goodwill. The ISB did receive mixed views during the post-implementation review of IFRS 3 on that. And given those mixed views, the ISB's preliminary views to make no changes in this area. And I'd say we have continued to hear mixed views on that during our outreach. So if I can now direct the members of both boards to the questions in our cover paper, so agenda paper 18, and we hope to structure the rest of the session based on a discussion of the disclosure ideas first, and then moving to goodwill, and then finally any other topics. So And I'll hand back to Sue, and perhaps Sue can start with disclosures.
Okay, thank you, Craig. So the rules of engagement. So trying to discuss question one first, so that the disclosure proposals in these two projects. So we can start playing a spot board member. So let me know if you would like to speak on disclosure first. Can't believe you're all so shy. Christine, you'll break the ice.
I just actually have a question for Craig, a curiosity question. So I appreciate from a theoretical perspective that there's a difference between fair value of goodwill and value in use. But from a practical perspective, when both are unobservable, how much of a difference is there in those measurements?
Yeah, so I guess that's on the goodwill section. Theoretically, as you said, the difference is one is based on how management are tending to use the asset or the CGU in practice, and the other is how the market would use it. I think stakeholders have given feedback that before these preliminary views, there was a bit of a difference, and particularly in terms of the cash flows that you can use. So one of the main differences being that the market would build in any potential for improvements in its valuation, whereas in value and use, they were restricted from doing so, so they weren't allowed to build in that. Some stakeholders during our outreach have said that if the board goes ahead with these preliminary views, then yes, there are some conceptual differences, but in practice, these will become very, very similar measurements. And so some have questioned whether the board should reconsider moving to just one of those two approaches.
Thanks, that helps. And then one question about the disclosures. So one of the concerns that I think we've all heard about the impairment model is the difficulty of tracking the acquisition after the acquisition has been integrated into the rest of the business. So I'm just wondering if you perceive there being sort of a difference in whether that is a real or a not real concern when it comes to disclosures versus how it plays into the impairment test.
Yeah, I mean, in theory, the disclosures are, as I said, a management-based approach. So they're based on whatever management internally are using. And they might be looking at different things. So that perhaps the impairment test, while it might build in some of the assumptions from like management's KPIs, ideally, maybe there might be a difference in terms of how you actually go about tracking those on an ongoing basis. Because the impairment test is an annual process, you know, you only come to that once a year. But the disclosures you might look at more frequently and more often. And so that might mean that those disclosures are reviewed a lot more than perhaps the impairment test are. And again, the disclosures, if there is integration, which I think is where one of the problems might arise, is that management might be monitoring things on a combined basis. So when the plan is to integrate things very quickly, perhaps you have during your bid process, for example, cost synergies, for example, obviously you might be tracking them as coming out of both the existing and the combined business rather than the acquired business on its own. And so you might be using combined metrics for both.
Okay, thanks, Christine. Hal.
Craig, first of all, I wish you best of luck on disclosures. This has been the holy grail for investors for decades. They would love to hear these performance metrics. My question is really about time frame. There's a wide range of how companies are integrated after acquisition, from no integration to full integration and done very quickly. And as I've talked to companies over the years, they talk about this speed of integration and how the metrics tend to lose their value over time. So are you contemplating some type of, I don't want to call it sunset, but provision where after a certain amount of time, those statistics are no longer provided? Or if management continues to, for example, say this is a standalone acquisition, we're not going to integrate it at all, you'd provide those metrics in perpetuity versus someone who gets integrated within 6 months?
Yes, there is a little bit of timing in here. So the board's preliminary views are that a company should continue to disclose the information on those metrics for as long as management and monitoring whether those acquisition date objectives are being met. So that's the time frame. There is built into the BSB's preliminary views a kind of assumption that management are monitoring the performance of their acquisitions, at least in the first few years. And so the management, the ISB is presuming that that happens in the year of acquisition and the two subsequent annual periods. And so they're expecting information to be disclosed during that period. But if a company stops monitoring during that period, then it has to disclose the fact that it stopped monitoring and the reason for that. So the reason might be that all those metrics have been met and they're happy with the performance.
So if it were a standalone acquisition that was all management was kept in place, there was no integration, you would provide those metrics in perpetuity, because presumably management, the acquiring company's management, would continue to track that performance?
Not necessarily in perpetuity. So it's for as long as you're assessing it against the assumptions that you made at the time of acquisition.
Against the acquisition assumptions. Okay, yeah. Good. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Jim?
Having trouble unmuting. So I wondered if there's been any discussion or commentary on the disclosures, business combination vis-a-vis other and growth strategies. So organic growth or significant asset acquisitions. Some industries, you know, maybe the acquired piece looks more like an asset acquisition than a a business combination. And so, you know, I think it's really, why did you make a significant investment and how do you measure the return on that investment? And that's not unique necessarily to business combinations. Obviously, the size of the investment might tend to be bigger when it's a business combination. But, you know, as we've seen that tension between asset acquisition and business combination, I don't know if there's been any feedback on should the scope be expanded to all significant investments.
Yes, so there has been a few stakeholders who have mentioned that, and you said exactly that. Why is this limited to just business combinations? Why is it not a wider set? Obviously, the reason that these disclosures have been proposed for business combinations is because the feedback from investors was in the context of the post-implementation review of IFRS 3, which is the board's standard on business combinations. But as you say, I think, yes, some have questioned why it's limited just to business combinations. It is perhaps not clear if they like these disclosures and want it extended to lots of different things, or whether you're saying that is it a reason not to have these disclosures at all, is it perhaps less clear in the feedback that it has come up.
Thanks. Sue Cosper.
Good morning. I was interested and curious about the application of the CODM approach. And at least for us, it's been a very challenging concept. And certainly we've had a segments project underway for several years now. And while the objective of that project is not defining the CODM, you know, I think it certainly has come to our attention the sort of wide-ranging types of information that's provided to the CODM from company to company, depending on their level of sophistication, their systems, et cetera. And so I just wondered if you had concerns about consistency and comparability by utilizing a CODM approach, and whether you are finding there's any actual inherent consequences that could arise to your actual segment standard as a result of using your CODM approach. And I guess it's more of a complexity of application question, or maybe an operationality question, as well as the utility of the information that you might get. So I'll pause there.
I mean, I guess whether the ISB member concerned about comparability, I will have to leave to the ISB members to say. But in terms of the feedback that we've received, there has been a few stakeholders have said that they are concerned about using the CODM approach because they are concerned about how that's actually defined in practice. Yeah, I guess it's not something that we've heard very frequently so far, but it has come up from a few stakeholders.
Maybe I'll take the opportunity of being the chair to chip in, because we had quite a debate on the CODM cut being used as the basis for the analysis. And I think the board's preliminary view was to use the CODM, even though we acknowledged it wasn't perfect, if you like, at least it was a concept people understood. And it was an idea that was presented in the document on the basis that it was a way that we hoped would enable a balance between getting the really important information to investors without overloading, particularly in the case where you had a company that was very acquisitive and where there were some concerns that just a materiality cut in itself might not get the right level of information into the financial statements. But we did have a bit of debate about the pros and cons, including some of the sorts of things that you're raising. So I'm sure we'll look forward to some more of that, won't we, Craig? Mary?
Thanks, Sue, and thanks to both Joy and Craig. Just on the point, Sue, that you were just commenting on, I think I probably have more in the nature of comments than questions. The, you know, another aspect of the why did we use CODM comes back to some of the feedback we had from investors, and Nick's here, and will correct me if I get this wrong, but was they wanted to know this post-acquisition performance against expectations for what ended up being called the game-changing acquisitions. So that's Sue, to your a mere materiality cut wouldn't have been effective. So rather than trying to develop yet another layer of more than material, is that significant? Do we have different vocabulary? I think we were looking to leverage something that we had, and it was the question of, if it's a game changer, wouldn't you expect the CODM to be monitoring performance versus expectations? And if not, that was probably material information. And then back to the point about integration and Hal's concern / question about, well, Helen, I think others, about the degree of integration making it difficult to provide the post-acquisition information. Again, things that we have to work through, but I think if let's say you were making an acquisition with an intention of integrating it into an existing operation, I would expect that the metrics that you set for measuring whether or not it was a successful acquisition would be based on an integrated unit. So it isn't that you have to be able to track that acquisition on a standalone basis, but it's asking the question, kind of going back to the point on one of Craig's slides about you give information at the time of the transaction to, in effect, sell the deal to the shareholders. How do you monitor whether or not that basis is achieved after the acquisition? So it doesn't have to be that you monitor, that you measure it on a standalone basis, especially if your expectation from the beginning was to integrate. And then the third is very much my personal take on kind of the evolution of our thinking on this project to focus on the disclosures. You know, Hal, it sounds like you've been an apostle for these disclosures for a very long time on their own. But I'd say that to me, it was a realization that investors, and I think this is echoed in some of Joy's slides, some are using the impairment information as confirmatory evidence. Some of them are using it as a very crude measure of a way to monitor the post-acquisition performance. It's crude because it has buffers like headroom. It's crude because it's lagging, and it's crude because it's one-sided. We tried, you know, we worked really hard for a couple of years to try and make the impairment test more sensitive, you know, more timely, more targeted on goodwill, or, you know, trying to deal with the headroom approaches. And having encountered difficulties on all of those, it really was a prompt for us to, in effect, reverse and say, what was the, you know, what's the objective and what's the user need? And if the user need is more timely and better information about the post-acquisition performance of game-changing acquisitions, can we answer that more directly by focusing on disclosure instead of working hard to tune the impairment test? So I guess I just wanted to offer that as my observations in terms of how I think we landed where we are. And I think, you know, based on the feedback that the outreach that I've been involved in, yes, there are some challenges, but I hope I get the sense that we're probably focused on an important issue. So in that sense, the right issue. Thanks, Sue.
Thanks, Mary. Gary.
I found it interesting that both, you know, Craig and Joy's comments generally are what we, it's consistent from investors. You know, first, goodwill amortization, investors are, you know, don't support that. We frequently hear that if you do go down the amortization path, we're simply going to pro forma it out. The disclosure route, though, I think we're hearing from numerous investors, you know, could you provide better disclosures post-acquisition? And I think, you know, similar to the feedback that you've heard and we've heard, just in my experience, when a company announces a deal, you're paying a 30-40% premium. So you have to have an earnings slide deck. I mean, an acquisition slide deck. You have a conference call. For most of your big shareholders, you come and present in person. Why are we doing this? Typically, it's for cost savings. You know, we eliminate the corporate headquarters. That saves $300 million. And then second, the revenue enhancement. You know, either I expand globally for in a new geographic region, or I add a product lineup. I think, Craig, you highlighted it perfectly that, you know, and I think piggybacking on Hal's comments, that if it's a separate, if I make an acquisition and it's a separate operating segment, I can track what's going on pretty straightforward, right? You're going to see revenue, you're going to see some operating margin. The point that Hal made, that Mary was talking about, that Craig, that you highlighted, you know, once you integrate, for example, an acquisition, let's say you have three operating segments and you fold the acquisition into two or three of them, then it becomes much more complicated because it gets lost in that embedded or integrated unit of the operating segment. So I think what you're doing makes a lot of sense from an investor perspective. And I think we should probably think about it too. You know, just, you know, withstanding the complications of how you actually would track this over the next 1, 2, 3 years.
Thanks, Gary. And Nick.
Thanks, Sue. So just building on Gary's comments, he's right that investors do have strong views on the subsequent treatment of goodwill. But I think their prime focus is getting a better understanding of the economics of M&A transactions. And this is where disclosures help. I think getting the threshold level right will be a challenge. I'm not sure whether yet, given the feedback we've had. But I just wanted to ask Craig. Craig's done an awful lot of our outreach here. Whether he has a sense of whether providing the subsequent information about the performance of acquisitions will help investors hold management better to account for those decisions. One thing that certainly sticks in my mind was comments we heard, I think, from a couple of preparers themselves who thought that these disclosures would result actually in better acquisition decisions. So actually knowing that they'd have to make these disclosures subsequently would have a bearing in the price that they paid. But Craig, in terms of what have you heard, will it achieve that primary objective in terms of improving accountability?
I think that's certainly what investors have told us. I think the majority of investors in the outreach that I've been have definitely said so, and they definitely welcome these additional disclosures being required.
Okay, thank you. To Dow, and then maybe we can move. Oh no, and then Bruce. To Dow, and then Bruce.
Okay, thank you. So, actually, is a question, a curiosity, actually, to the FASB team, is that we are looking at as other topics for intangible identification of intangibles in our project, but I understood that that is something more in relation to the disclosure of the identification of intangibles in the FASB project. I mean, that instead of just not just identifying these intangible assets or even identifying less intangible assets, but providing a bit more information about the agreements behind these intangibles. If you could clarify, because I understand that in a certain way, it is already expected that some of the most important agreements would be in the financial statement. But I think that might be something else in the FASB's proposal. If you could please just clarify that one, please.
So Sue, maybe I could jump in there. I didn't hear Joy responding. I think what's referred to as our research project on intangibles and disclosure. And obviously it's looking to see what information we should or could present there. I will say that research project's at its infancy and likely to be, I will say, expanded slightly to deal with not just disclosure, but also accounting for intangibles from a research perspective. That would be separate and apart from this project. I wasn't sure if that answered the question.
No, well, I think that it's just, actually, to be honest, I'm trying to build on something that the FASB is doing to try to see whether what we are proposing, the ISB, and the feedback that we are getting from our stakeholders. Because this, especially in relation to this topic, intangible, I'm trying to figure out, and I think that could be a good idea, that if we can get more qualitative disclosure, not only quantitative disclosure, that sometimes just guessing a number, and there is a lot of complaint from the stakeholders that's quite difficult to end in a good number in terms of accuracy. And then sometimes some, maybe having a more improved disclosure would be interesting. But yes, that's what I would like to know. Thank you.
Thank you. Bruce.
Thank you, Sue, and pleasure to meet all you, if not virtually, hopefully soon. Just a comment. I come in from a slightly unique position because I only joined the board after the discussions happened on the discussion papers. So it's conscious I wasn't part of all of those. But in my previous life, I spent a lot of time with preparers. And what's quite interesting when you hear preparers' views on this is, and I can appreciate a lot of you, especially from the user side. The users love these disclosures. They want more metrics. They want more information that's been put in there. I would just comment that from a preparer perspective, there's a lot of concern about being able to give those disclosures. And it's not always necessarily the market sensitivity. Yes, they are concerned about the market sensitivity, and I certainly wouldn't take that away. I guess it's also just ties in a bit with what Christine was saying around that difficulty around the tracking. And I think the concern they've got is that as that time period pushes out, and I think we need to realize that, I mean, the speed of business right now is accelerated. So we may be talking 1 year, 2 years, 3 years. In the life cycle of an acquisition, 2 years down the line, a lot of them have said that the concern is that the reliability of what they would be tracking, even though it is a year, only 2 years down the line, could become very difficult, especially if it's a fast-moving group, especially if they're continually reorganizing. So I just think it's not always, I mean, I think a lot of people harp on the market sensitivities, and as I said, don't discount that as a point. But I think just be conscious that especially in fast-moving industries, this could be very difficult for people to make that comment.
Hal, are you using the old-fashioned hands in the air approach?
Yes, thank you, Sue. Bruce, just to follow up on your observations, is it financial metrics that they are more challenged with providing, or is it operating metrics? And the distinction here is financials coming from, you know, the general ledger and accounting numbers versus how many customers were retained from the last acquisition? Which one is more problematic?
Interestingly, I think it depends on which side you were coming from. So I think the sensitivities around the success of the business combination was very much more around, what have we set up front in terms of things like, is this going to increase my revenue? What are the metrics around customers, that type of thing. But I think from the financial reporting point of view, it's not always as easy for them as just opening the ledger and seeing exactly what was there. If I just think of one of the groups I worked with, they were highly acquisitive. They really, when they brought people in, they broke them up, they put them around the group. Speaking to the guys who are doing this, they just said, by the time they are literally a year to 18 months down the line, sometimes the identification of those CGUs or how they were looking at it, it just became very, very difficult. So I think it's a mix between the two. And I think both of those could cause concerns.
And Bruce, that time frame is the same I've heard over the years as well. Once you get past 2 years, it becomes very difficult.
Okay. Gary, do you still have your hand up from last time, or did you want to come back in?
I wanted to come back in, but if somebody else is in line, that's fine.
Okay. No, you come in while you're speaking, and then Anne, and then I'm keen to move to the second question.
Just in terms of Tadu's comment on intangibles, if you think about the FASB, when it was founded in 1973, the five largest companies in the U.S. were GM, Exxon, Ford, GE, and Chrysler. Today, 25% of the market is Facebook, Amazon, Apple, Microsoft, and Google. So if you go back to the founding of the board, the balance sheet was a very important metric to look at for tangible asset companies. Income statement cash flow is also important. You move to today, if you listen to the conference calls for the FANG, now it's the FAMG rather than FANG companies, the whole focus is on the income statement and cash flow, revenues, margin, and cash flows, right? So how do we better inform investors? And most investors, I believe, are in the camp of, we don't think you can put these quote intangibles on balance sheet reliably or measure reliably. And it's really looking for more disclosure, to your point. I think we're hearing that consistently. The trick is, it's not that simple to write a standard that requires intangibles for many different industries. That's how I kind of think about it. Thanks.
Okay, thanks. We're at risk of setting Nick off soon, all of this intangible chat. Anne.
Thanks, Sue. I wanted to come back to the point that Bruce and Hal were talking about and the practical difficulties we've heard. I wanted to just mention something that's on that point, but on the other side, and that's the feedback we get from people that say we shouldn't be requiring these disclosures. It's not part of financial reporting. So these are the people that Craig referred to that say this belongs in the management commentary. But for some people, goes more than that. It's just they just don't think. They think it's quite unreasonable that we've gone into this area and we're talking about different sorts of reporting. And although we've tried to say and refer to user needs and the demands that are there, there are others in that group that say there's no conceptual basis for what we're doing. And it's just really quite a step away from financial reporting as we think about it and as we develop our standards. So they're coming at the no vote from quite a different way. Thank you.
Thanks, Anne. Now, I think in the interest of time, let's move on to the second question in paper 18. So whether either of you have questions or comments that you want to make about the million-dollar question, the subsequent accounting for goodwill that we're looking at in each of our projects. Rika, would you like to come in?
So thank you. I have one comment, I mean, rather comment, maybe that's a request to all participants of this joint meetings. And one more is a question to Joy. First thing is about feedback possibly received in connection with the comparability of the two framework, meaning US GAAP and IFRS. Actually, we are now living in the world that two standards have not exactly the same, but very same framework about subsequent measurement of goodwill. So I'm from a jurisdiction that the company have the option of three standards and also two models of subsequent measurement of goodwill existing one market. So I observe the coexistence of two models in the same market, and that impact substantial. And I think that affect the behavior of market participants significantly. So an example can be a management strategic plan and scheme for acquisition. And also they made a decision to transit to one accounting standard to another because of that. So I'm afraid to say, especially considering cross-border acquisition, coexistence of two models in major global markets could invite unintended consequence that we cannot imagine at this moment. So, but having said that, I understand because both boards are looking at different stakeholders and the different aspect of environment in the global market. So it might be inevitable that the decision of converged standards could be different in the end. But still, I think it's very important for us, both boards, to sit together to share the project status and views on material issue of this project as same as today. So I hope we can have continuing dialogue between two boards in the future as well. And that's a request. And my question to Joy is about slide 8. And Joy mentioned about the default period of maybe it's amortization period. And it seems like the management can set longer or shorter period, even though there is a default period. So I'm just wondering, have you also considered or are you going to consider that default can be a kind of the maximum number, like a longest period, like 10, 15, 20, or I don't know what number is like, but do you have any thought about this?
Hi, Rika, thanks for your question. For sure, in terms of the default period or using the default as a cap, the way you described, I think in terms of, I know Hal was talking about this during the ed session last week, in that could there be potential information utility differences between these two types? And the way we thought about it is that if it was and of course it depends on what that number is, that you know, amortization period, but if it was a default, an ability to justify below or above, potentially the information utility could be anywhere below that number or above that number. Whereas if it was made to be a cap, the only potential utility there could be would be below that number. And so we do understand that there are certain standards out there that do, you know, apply the cap methodology. But certainly to your comment, Rika, originally about, you know, coexistence of two models and the optionality within the same market, you know, similarly from the invitation to comment, we received feedback that was the number one most important comparability aspects that our comment letter respondents had basically told us that no optionality should be allowed in terms of the model within public business entities, at least.
Thank you, Joy. I also interested in to what the extent of the disclosure can be provided by companies to investors when applying the amortization method is also interested. And because currently the ISB is thinking based on the applying the impairment model, what type of the information can be provided at a reasonable cost for preparer and still useful for at a reasonable cost for preparers and useful for investors. So if we need if you are going to think about the difference between the information can be provided prepared when applying amortization model and when applying impairment model is very interesting to me. Thank you.
Thank you. Jing Chao.
Thank you, Sue. Also, thank you. Thanks, Joy, for your update. I think those information are very useful, very helpful, particularly your project a little bit ahead of us. I think those messages, and you are trying to develop some proposals once amortization approach introduced. I do have two questions or maybe two clarifications. When I look at the amortization period approach you developed or you try to approach four approaches here, and I think you have considered the information value and the cost perspective, but when I look at those approaches and which approach we should think about, it always reminds me what's the underlying concept behind it. So first question still come back to the underlying concept, conceptual basis. I think once those conceptual basis clarified, it will helpful for us to move forward, which approach we should select. So as you mentioned that stakeholders, even maybe others have different views, whether goodwill is wasting assets or not, or whether goodwill we should look at the information useful needs, what kind of information more relevant to users. So what kind of underlying concept you have in mind when you develop those different approaches? Second question is about the notion of the facts and the circumstances of the acquisition. When I look at those four approaches, I realize that you introduce the notion of the effects and the circumstance of the acquisition, particularly regarded to the deviation or to the default approach and the management judgment. That notion actually plays a vital role of those approaches. So I'm thinking about whether there are any supporting guidance to better understand what's the meaning of the effects and the circumstance of the acquisition. For example, whether those facts and the circumstances of the acquisition is only limited to the facts and the circumstances of acquired business, or whether we should also consider the businesses and the assets and liabilities acquirer has, but will be combined to those acquired business after acquisition. Secondly, about the timing, because amortization actually related to the subsequent accounting. So whether we only focus on those facts and circumstances at acquisition date, or whether we still need to consider the facts and the circumstances after acquisition, because those facts and circumstances related to the acquisition, related to the business combination will be changed, will be evolving. So, but this notion is really important when I look at those four approaches. So hopefully if there's some further guidance, further clarification, I would be really appreciate. Thank you.
Sure. Thank you. Thank you for those questions. So let me try to first answer your first one related to the amortization period. And what potential conceptual basis might we be thinking about when providing proposals to it, especially given that the conceptual debate around whether goodwill is wasting or not is continue to be around. And so as many of us know and can think through that these acquisitions are very quite unique to not only the transaction itself, but to the entity. And so any kind of comparability, I would say, it's difficult to exist within if you're trying to assess a unique transaction. But what we did try to do in terms of, because it's so unique, thinking through proposals that really allow for that flexibility for management to determine, but also considering the conceptual, the cost benefit aspect of the project, knowing the struggles of impairment testing that there is today and very, very old dated goodwill balances that exist. And as a back pocket calculation that we tried to do, I think back in the 1990s, there was about $1 trillion of goodwill on the balance sheet, in the US at least, for public companies. And then fast forward to today, we have about anywhere between 3.5 to 5 that we're hearing trillion wise. And if impairments during this time period had only been about 2 to 3% over this lengthy period, we can almost imagine how much old goodwill there is out there. And that's continuing to be tested for impairments. Granted, knowing the length of it and how information utility for impairments really decreases over time, this is kind of shows the cost that's currently in the system. But to answer your question about any form of conceptual basis, what the team tried to do is understand historically how long companies are, I would say, are living or like tend to exist in terms of the S&P 500, and seeing those trends over the years to be able to potentially provide to the board a default period, whether it's 10, 15, or 20 years as a basis to start with. And so in that sense, allowing that default period to be one that has some sort of background or history behind that analysis is one that we are attempting to do. If that answers your question, the first question. And then this, your second question about, certain facts and circumstances related to the acquired business versus, I guess, reviewing it at an entity level. What the staff has to do yet is to try to go back to the board on the unit of account analysis. And granted, if there was an amortization in place, the natural view of that is by on an acquisition level, whereas impairment testing, like you mentioned, is more on a reporting unit or a CGU level at a higher level. So there is a disconnect between these two, and whether or not how we move forward and the board decides on what is the proper unit of account is certainly to be made at a later date.
Thank you very much. I think it's clarified a lot. Just to come back to the first question, I wonder whether, because once you introduce the amortization approach, amortization is not new. It's already in existing standards. I wonder whether you have also looked at the existing amortization principle or concept, for example, amortization, which was included in the intangible assets or PPE standards. For example, when we look at how to determine the amortization period, for example, of the intangible assets, we will look at the pattern of the assets being consumed. So this kind of principle already there. And some people actually ask a question, if we introduce amortization, they wonder whether, because goodwill cannot generate cash flow individually, they will generate cash flow with other tangible assets, for example, PPE or other intangible assets. So they think that whether those principle, amortization principle, which was applied to tangible assets and other intangible assets, could also be an example or a proposal could be used, applied to goodwill. I'm not sure whether you have also considered this kind of approach.
Yeah, and certainly we have, and we try to compare and contrast, the different proposals of how goodwill is going, more from a practical perspective, and whether or not it aligns or doesn't align with the way intangible assets today are being amortized.
Okay, thank you. So Hans wants to know if I'll let him, and I guess I will. Hans?
Yes, please. Good morning, everybody. And I'm so sorry I couldn't be there from the very beginning due to some circumstances at home. I have a question for the FASB board, and perhaps it was already touched upon in the introduction, which I missed. But if you were to reintroduce amortization, Have you thought of the possibility of running the amortization charge through OCI? Given the fact that it is, whatever you do about the period, it's going to be very arbitrary. And secondly, knowing that most investors will back it out anyway, because they will see it as a distortion of the income statement. If you would run it through OCI, at least you get rid of the overtime of the goodwill as an asset on the balance sheet, which most of you believe is a wasting asset. So it would not keep on accumulating on the balance sheet. At the same time, you would not have what most people will regard as a distortion, or many people will regard as a distortion of the income statement. So you could have it both ways almost. Is that something that you have considered, or do you indeed think that it should truly be reflected in the income statement as a charge?
Who wants to answer that? Christine, old-fashioned hands up.
Thank you, Sue. Speaking personally, I think if we were going to go down that path, we could use exactly those same arguments for the impairment charge itself. Because the impairment charge is non-gapped out. It's viewed as non-cash. It's viewed as a distortion of the income statement in the period that it occurs, because it's a large, you know, if it's a large one-time charge, it's causing a distortion in sort of the core earnings. So I don't view that question as being directed only at, you know, if we amortize versus if we impair. So answering for both of those, I think whether we're on an impairment model or we're on an amortization model, those represent costs of an asset being consumed. It's just a difference of timing as to when it goes through the income statement. But I think that both should go through the income statement. Both are going to get non-gapped out at the end. That's fine, because they're both non-cash charges. But I don't really view amortization as different. It's just a difference in timing.
Okay, I'm guessing that a couple of people have put their hands up also want to respond. So, Rich?
Yeah, thanks, Sue, and thank Hans. I think it's fair to say that our board members have a bit of a love-hate relationship with other comprehensive income, and I haven't polled them, but sometimes there's more in the positive versus the negative category there. That being said, I do think that if we go down the goodwill amortization approach, which would include, I would assume, an impairment model also, we will have to deal with presentation. And whether that's some separate category in the income statement, maybe further down the line with net of tax, or whether that's up above the line, you know, up above what we would traditionally call net income, I think those would all be on the table. OCI, I think, is something we would have to consider, but I'm not sure the level of support that would get on our board, though.
Thank you. Now, Martin and Mary, I haven't forgotten you, but I just want to see if the other FASB members are responding to Hans's question. So Hal and Jim. So Hal first, sorry, and then Jim.
I was going to let Jim go because he jumped in first. So.
Sorry, I couldn't remember. Jim?
So, Hans, as I've thought about this, and I don't know whether OCI is the answer, but I do think, to Rich's point, we really have to consider special presentation. I think this would be probably the most non-gapped out number, probably more than anything we already do. I think we would hear the criticism that we've made net income less relevant by introducing amortization. So whether it's, you know, net income before goodwill amortization, or put it in OCI or something that helps balance that. And I take Christine's point that people also non-gap, you know, impairment, they all also non-gap amortization of intangibles. So it becomes a slippery slope, but I think we're going to have to address that criticism if we move forward.
And I would agree with Jim. I would agree with Jim that we have to address the criticism, but I'd point out in Craig's slides that he went through earlier on page 5, there's an argument there for the feedback you heard for amortization, but I thought the salient point was, is that you paid for something. At some point, it has to flow through net income, and it gets back to the issue of, well, what did you pay for? And I happen to be in a camp that you actually are paying for quite often earnings over the next few years. So, you know, while I would agree it's going to be a debate, I think there's a really strong argument for why it should at some point flow through net income.
Okay, thank you. Hans, sorry, can I get you to mute if that's all right? Sorry to be bossy,
yeah, sure.
It's just a bit echoey. Martin was next.
Okay, thanks, Sue. I have a short question. And the subsequent accounting of goodwill is between the FASB and the IFRS currently more or less converged. And in your outreach regarding to your project, have you heard that convergence regarding amortization, yes or no, or impairment only test is still important? Because when I have done here, at least in my home country in Germany, the outreach, many people were in favor of amortization, but they said, okay, it should be, if that will be happened, only in line with what the FASB is doing, because they are concerned about competitive disadvantages. If one accounting standard setter says, okay, we're introducing amortization and others are not. So my question is, do you have heard similar voices, especially from preparers? Are they concerned about convergence any longer, or was that not an important topic in your outreach? Thanks.
Yes, Martin, to answer your question, we did hear a few comment letter respondents mention this as well, in terms of maintaining largely converged standards for those same reasons that you mentioned.
Thank you. I'm Mary.
Okay. A couple of observations, and they're very personal, and I think I will express them in a flippant fashion, but it doesn't detract from the fact that they are pretty deep-seated concerns for me. And I'm going to start with bad, Hans. Bad. You're not supposed to raise OCI as a band-aid or a tool when we face hard issues. That's one of the things we learned from the conceptual framework project. Should be used very sparingly and only as a last resort. So bad, Hans. The second thing, and it's focusing on this issue, and I'm thinking about Joy's slide 8, which lays out the different amortization period approaches. And my flippant comment about this is it demonstrates to me how the road to hell often is paved with good intentions, because we look at it and see that management judgment only is the thing that would be expected to produce the most, you know, is the way to get useful information from the amortization of goodwill, but it comes at a very high cost. And then the default is the one that has the lowest cost, but having been able to actually sit in on your roundtables about a year ago, certainly my recollection is that all of the users who spoke said that if that's done, it would absolutely remove any meaning from that number. While some of them said they might get some information if it was not just entity specific, but acquisition specific in terms of an amortization period. And so I very much understand and empathize with the desire to, can we find something in the middle, which leads to the considerations of some of the defaults with option or management judgment then default. But I caution about that, because to me, if it doesn't have meaning, then all we're doing is getting rid of an inconvenient truth. And the inconvenient truth is that this is the premium that was paid for this acquisition. And the more you get to whittle away at it in a fashion that you can dismiss as an accounting convention and a non-cash charge, and whittle away, especially in the good periods, it means that you're not held accountable for the investment decision that was made. So I want to be very clear that those are very much my personal views about my thinking about this issue. But I do worry if we start to rationalize, well, we have to hit some kind of compromise that gets in the middle, and as a result, lose both cost benefits and information benefits. Thanks for letting me rant in a flippant fashion.
Oh, Hans is going to respond to being told off. Hans?
Yeah, before I am being shamed publicly by Mary, may I draw your attention to our conceptual framework, which says that OCI, yes, it is a last resort, but you can use it if it improves the relevance of the income statement. And I think you personally would probably agree that if it were to go outside the income statement, go into OCI, it would improve the relevance of the income statement, wouldn't you, Mary?
I think that might be a discussion for another day.
I think we might need drinks, but I might invite Hal to come along with me.
Yeah. Okay. So with that, shall we move on to, I'm conscious of time again, so move on to question three and the topic of recognition of identifiable and tangible assets that we're both looking at in our projects. Nick, do you want to say something? This is usually a topic you're keen on.
Thanks, Sue. Yeah, I was just about to hit the button as it happens. So yes, intangible. So I recall at the last ASAF meeting, FASB staff provided an update on around the work, the revisions to the conceptual framework, and particularly the revisions on elements that you're looking at. And as part of that, I seem to recall there's a proposal that the recognition criteria for internally and acquired intangibles would be aligned. It would be the same. It wouldn't matter whether they were acquired or internally generated. And I was just wondering whether that direction of travel be reflected in this current project, or whether it's more likely to be something for the research project that Rick mentioned earlier. Thank you.
Does someone from the FASB want to respond to that?
So, Nick, obviously we are moving ahead on the goodwill portion of this project. The reason we have a research project on intangibles, it was originally just focused on disclosure, but we've certainly heard the attention on the large amount of value that's not on the balance sheet, the challenges with that, providing transparency to it. So I think the research project will inform us. And while we may ultimately combine them, I think we're going to see more progress in the research project than we are here on the standard setting portion for this. That would be my view.
Thanks.
Did anybody else have any comments they wanted to make or questions on identifiable intangibles? Sorry, we can bring the section then on goodwill and impairment together unless the staff wanted to say anything before we close out. No? Okay. Thank you very much. An interesting session and a project, I think, that certainly from our side, I'm sure from yours as well, we'll be keen to keep following one another's work given the current Converge situation. So as we get more information following our comment period closing, and we'll be keen to keep in touch both via the staff and at a board level in terms of the feedback and next steps, and keen to hear how your discussions progress as well. But thank you very much, an interesting discussion. Can I hand to you now, Rich, to hand over to the leases session?
Certainly, and thank you, Sue, and you set a very high bar. You came in 1 minute under, so I'm impressed we got through all of that. So I'll do my best in this next session.